I'm sorry. I have a headache through my entire body.
And my doctor, he don't help either. He told me to run 5 miles a day for 2 weeks. I called him up. I said, Doc, I'm 70 miles from my house.
Oh, you got that flu? Drink a lot of fluids and get plenty of rest. Man, I'm glad I ran into you. I was going to do wind sprints and dehydrate myself. Are you sure you're not a doctor?
I'm going to be sick.
All right, take it easy. I know stress is the number one cause of herpes. Headaches.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
I tell you, I meet the wrong people. That's my trouble. Like last week, I met the Surgeon General. He offered me a cigarette.
We found this one swimming naked in the fermentarium.
I am the lizard queen!
Give her this, and this, and then these.
Oh, thank you, Doctor.
No, I'm not a doctor.
You know, you should play with Dr. Beeper and myself. I mean, he's been club champion for 3 years running, and I'm no slouch myself.
Don't sell yourself short, Judge. You're a tremendous slouch.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday House Call, taking your health-related questions at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580, so free phone call on Bell Mobility, and a free long-distance call as well at 1-800-580-CFRA. And welcome back.
Thank you.
Great to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Let's get right to the phones. We've got some people waiting already. Maxville, Queenie.
Dr. Dworkin?
Yes.
I've spoken to you before about my macular degeneration condition.
Mm-hmm.
And the last injection that I had on Monday was Lucentis, but the blood has cleared up, so OHIP won't cover that any longer.
Hmm.
So the next material I'm going to have is Avastin.
Okay.
And I was wondering if you could tell me if there's any word of that being approved by the FDA as yet.
Well, I know that the Avastin is approved for other uses, but it was used interchangeably with Lucentis as a means of treating macular degeneration because it was cheaper, I believe, to use the Avastin because you could divide the dose up as opposed to Lucentis, which was a single-use dose, if my memory is correct. So they're both approved medications. It's whether the indication for use specifically for macular degeneration is approved or not.
Would you tell me that again?
Yeah, because both medications can be used.
Uh-huh.
The issue is that one of them is specifically indicated, the Lucentis is specifically indicated to treat wet-type macular degeneration.
Yes.
Whereas the Avastin is used for other illnesses,
yes,
but was used, I believe, for the treatment of macular degeneration because it did have an effect.
Uh-huh.
But it's not officially approved to do that. It wasn't licensed or approved by the FDA or Health Canada to treat macular degeneration, but rather other conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But that still doesn't mean it can't be used because from a clinical standpoint, there have been ophthalmologists that have used this,
mm-hmm,
and it has been effective for treating.
No, it must be more than a year ago. I did have some Avastin, and then bleeding started again,
mm-hmm,
and then I had to go back to the Lucentis, and the Lucentis is covered by OHIP, but
right,
the Avastin isn't.
That's right, and it's not covered because for the treatment of that condition, it doesn't have an official approval to do so. And that's why. Whereas the Lucentis, because it's approved for that use, has a better chance of being covered for the same reason that insurance companies, even private insurance companies, will cover a medication for a specific indication, but they may not cover it if the medication is being used what we call off-label, that is, off what it usually was designed to be used for.
Uh-huh. Now, is there any chance that it would be covered later on?
That I have no idea. I am not a Ministry of Health bureaucrat on how they make those decisions. There are a lot of things that I have a problem with in how they approve or don't approve certain medications.
Uh-huh. Well, I just thought I'd give you a call and question that.
Okay.
But anyway.
Well, good luck, Queenie.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you
very
for your
welcome.
Call. We have lots of phone lines available, folks, at 521-TALK. Star 580, free phone call if you're on Bell Mobility. And a free long-distance call as well, 1-800-580-CFRA. Mark has been filling in for Steve Madeley in the morning. I heard you earlier in this week talking about menopause and estrogen and women who are menopausal turning to soy-based food products in order to ease some of the symptoms, hot flashes, what have you. What do you think about that?
Well, the thrust of that is that for many, many women, there's been a, as you know, a lot of studies that have that came out in the past that questioned whether the use of estrogen to treat hot flushes was a safe thing to do. There were questions pertaining to potential increase in breast cancer risk or uterine cancer. And the original study, as it was produced, seemed to come out to say that there was a danger in doing that. But after further analysis of the same study and looking at the women that were involved in this study, you had to stratify or divide up the age of the women that were involved in it. So, for example, you saw more of the concern and the outcomes, the negative outcomes, in women who are older, that is, in their 60s, who are taking estrogen, as opposed to women who are 48, 50, 55 years old, where you didn't see that effect. So there was, you have to be very careful about the population of people that are involved in the study and how the medication is going to affect them. So in this case, the revision and the revised recommendations are that there is no evidence to suggest that using low-dose estrogen, which, by the way, is less than the dose that is used in the birth control pill in terms of estrogen content, that low-dose estrogen in perimenopausal or menopausal women in their late 40s.
What's perimenopausal? Sorry.
Peri means around menopause. So they're starting to get hot flushes, but they have a period from time to time.
Okay.
Periods haven't stopped completely. But for those women who are experiencing what we call intractable symptoms, that is, their quality of life is severely affected by the hot flushes and other symptoms that can accompany menopause, changes through menopause, that taking estrogen, usually in combination with a progesterone, if a woman has an intact uterus, meaning they haven't had a hysterectomy, you would take combinations called combination therapy, so it mitigates or minimizes any risk with regards to uterine cancer. And there's no evidence that taking that for several years or a year or so is going to cause an increased risk of breast cancer, especially if there's no family history of breast cancer, there's no history of having had breast cancer, estrogen-sensitive breast cancer. So you have to be aware of those things. But the point is that estrogen works very well. There is a push to say, well, what about soy? Well, soy has estrogen-like compounds in it that was thought to be able to, again, reverse or reduce the hot flushes. But they found in these particular studies not very much evidence to suggest that it did as purported. So the bottom line is that it always boils down to risk and benefit and quality of life. And the risk is very low for young women, you know, 48, 49, 50 years old, 52 years old. Anybody under the age of 60, for the most part, is only going to be taking it for about a year or two at the max. Recommendations are you can go 4 years with it, but really about a year or two is all that usually on average is required. And there's no long-term harm of it. And again, it's the dose. The dose of estrogen that's being used is extremely small. And again, if you've been taking the birth control pill, and for many women, they take birth control pill for decades, the estrogen content in those birth control pills far and above exceeds the estrogen that's in hormone replacement therapy.
Line 7 is Gary. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes, I was wondering, what would cause me to develop dry mouth at night when I sleep?
There's a lot of different things. That's a loaded question. I mean, dry mouth, in terms of mechanical reasons why you can get a dry mouth can occur from people who breathe through their mouths. You get a lot of evaporation. Also, environmental changes. So wintertime, we tend to have less humidity in the air. That'll dry things out. People who have nasal obstruction will tend to breathe through their mouth in order to bypass the nose. There are syndromes where the salivary glands do not function very well. There are different diseases that can cause connective tissue diseases, for example, where the body attacks its own tissues, muscle and other connective tissue, that can lead to dry mouth syndromes. There are hormonal diseases or deficiencies that can cause this as well. But really, there's a large list. So dry mouth in and of itself is potentially a symptom of something else, but usually there's associated other other issues that someone is having along with that dry mouth. So more than that, unfortunately, I can't give you a complete answer because it really, it's only one symptom that could represent many different types of conditions.
Are you having any other health problems, Gary? Or?
No, I think maybe it was the medication I was taking because I take a series of medication. I thought maybe that was...
Yeah, medications can do that too. You're absolutely right. So what medications are you taking?
Well, I take Metoprolol, Lipitor, Acupril, and aspirin.
Those shouldn't cause dry mouth, though. I mean, the metoprolol really doesn't really cause very much dry mouth. It's usually taking 25 or 50 milligrams or something.
25.
Yeah. Usually it can make you feel more tired, but not necessarily dry mouth. There are other medications that can do that. But is this something that started recently?
It's about a month ago.
Yeah, and you've been on these medications, I would imagine, for much longer than that.
20-some-odd years.
Yeah, so the question we have to ask is, what happened 1 month ago? So that's the issue. So, you know, has there been a change in household environment? Has there been, you know, has there been anything else that happened a month ago, illness-wise or symptom-wise? Those are the questions that your physician would ask you.
Correct.
In order to figure out if something new has happened that 1 month ago. But if it was medications, the dry mouth would have occurred at the time that you first started the medications.
But I know I was taking Lipitor, and then he gave me a generic drug.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the generic drug, I was all right. And then I got back on Lipitor, and it started when I got back on Lipitor.
Yeah, it's unlikely because you have been on the Lipitor before, and you have to be careful about what causes what.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would, you know, if this dry mouth is becoming a major issue, some of the things that you can do just to see if this helps is to make sure you have a cool mist humidifier in the room, that the room is not overly warm or dry,
right?
And see if that helps. Also to check and see, you know, again, if I don't know if there's an issue with regards to snoring, because that would indicate obstructions if you've got some snoring, and that can also cause a dry mouth. So there are different things that need to be looked at from an anatomical standpoint as well to ensure that, you know, if you're breathing through your mouth, that's going to contribute to the dry mouth.
Right.
And if this happened, you know, a month ago, your nose start to get more blocked up or obstructed, that could certainly be one of the contributing factors. But really, that requires an examination in order to determine that.
Correct. All right. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Gary.
Good luck, Gary.
Bye now.
More of your phone calls coming up after the 3:30 news. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday House Call on 580 CFRA.
I've been trying to swim a lot, you know. You always hear swimming's the best exercise, but have you seen how fat whales are? Whales, they're like swimming all the time. It's not working, whales. Not working. Wouldn't it be great if we found out whales were in complete denial about how huge they are? It's mostly water weight. A lot of water weight. Once after a show, someone came up to me and they're like, you know, whales aren't fat, they have a layer of blubber. I thought calling myself Big Bone was a cop out. Blubber? That's like the opposite of muscle. It goes like muscular, toned, flabby, and then like a mile away is blubber. Fat made a noise, would be blubber.
I don't know where they find this stuff. That's a good one. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's the Wednesday House Call, and every single phone line is available right now. We have cured every illness and condition in the Ottawa region right now. 521-TALK, *580, 1-800-580-CFRA. So big story this week about grapefruit juice.
Mm-hmm.
Could be deadly if it's mixed with a growing list of medications that can interact with grapefruit juice, cause serious effects. This was a major story from CBC News. Everything from cholesterol-lowering drugs to blood thinners can interact with otherwise harmless foods. Makes it prudent to read labels on prescribed medications and ask a doctor if there's anything that should be avoided when taking a particular drug. For example, they talk about avoiding foods that are high in vitamin K, such as parsley, coriander, leafy greens like spinach, soybeans, chickpeas, cheddar cheese, and green tea, as well as black licorice. I love black licorice.
Oh, you're a freakazoid too.
Is this much ado about nothing, or is this a serious issue?
No, it's important. And the reason is that, again, food has chemical compounds. There's chemicals in everything, right? Mm-hmm. It's normal. That's And so if you think of how medications are processed, they have to be absorbed first. So usually you swallow them. You can apply it as patches, goes through the skin, but they have to be absorbed. So there are certain foods that can hinder the absorption of the medication through the channels that the body has in the intestine to allow that medication to then reach the bloodstream. So that's one way that it can do things. There's also processing. That is, our livers are our biochemical factories. You know, the liver does thousands upon thousands of different enzyme systems. And these enzyme systems, just to give it a name, are called cytochromes. And there are, if you think of a factory, Rob, let's make it an easy analogy, a car plant, right? You've got your engine assembly line, you've got your chassis assembly line, you've got your paint stations, you've got all these different stations. Each has a specific function. And the liver has different channels as well. It has different departments that will process different types of medications depending on the conveyor belt it chooses or the department it chooses. And so the foods that you can consume can block that engine assembly plant, or it could block the other conveyor belt that takes the parts to a certain department. And it either can speed up that conveyor belt or slow it down. So that's where having certain foods like vitamin K, for example, and blood thinners. Vitamin K is an antidote to an overdose for Coumadin. So in effect, it reverses the blood thinning properties of Coumadin. And so someone who's taking vitamin K and has a condition like atrial fibrillation where their heart, if they are not on Coumadin, can develop a blood clot that can go to the brain and cause a stroke. So if they're consuming foods that reduce the effectiveness of Coumadin, they increase their risk of that. So that's sort of the idea behind
alcohol is the big one, though, right?
Alcohol wreaks havoc with all the conveyor belts in the liver at the same time.
Okay. Suddenly we have got full phone lines. That's all it took. let's go to Glenn in Ottawa. Glenn.
Hi.
Hi, Glenn.
Well, I have two questions that I'll ask him, and then I'll just go and listen on the radio.
Sure thing.
Okay.
My first question is, I have two grandchildren, and I like tickling them under their toes, under their feet, and I'm just wondering whether or not this is healthy.
Okay.
My second question is the liver. It can be recuperated, right?
Correct.
Okay. Not any other organ.
The liver is the only organ in the body that can completely regenerate itself.
Really?
I
thought cirrhosis was permanent, though.
That's different, yes, because cirrhosis means the entire liver is affected. It's completely scarred up, and you can't recover from a completely cirrhotic liver. But that's why when you do liver transplants, Rob, you don't need a whole liver to do the transplant. You just need a part of it. Hmm. And when you implant it, as long as it has a blood supply and it's not rejected by the body, it will regenerate itself.
Really?
So that's why if someone is experiencing liver damage, so say they are... They're drinking and they're causing liver damage. You don't get cirrhosis overnight. It happens over decades of abuse.
Yep.
So you do tests on the liver. You find out the enzyme levels are elevated. Enzyme levels in your bloodstream tell you that the liver cells have been broken open because those enzymes are normally inside the liver itself. So if the liver is being damaged, fluid leaks out, it goes into the bloodstream, and you can tell how much damage the liver has. But even then, if you haven't proceeded to cirrhosis of the liver, if you stop drinking, your liver will repair itself and you can have a normal liver afterwards. It's like going up the hill, and if you before you get to the top of the hill to fall over the other side, if you stop, you're not going to end up going over that cliff. Right. So that's
the liver is the only one that does that. I don't think that's true. Your lungs, for example, if you're a smoker, your lungs repair themselves, right?
The difference is that you're right. The lung will repair itself, but the liver actually generates more organ. You actually get a normal sized liver again after a while.
Okay.
So your liver, it's the only organ. It's like animals that where you cut off their tail grows back. Right. Mm. This is the same thing in our bodies with regards to the liver. The liver will grow back. The lung, if it gets damaged from smoking, yes. If you stop smoking, the areas of the lung that were not permanently damaged can reverse that damage and heal themselves. But those areas that are permanently damaged, where there's emphysema and literally pockets or holes in the lung, those will stay. Those won't recover. So it's what you're doing when you stop smoking is you are giving the remainder of your lung, and because you have two lungs and a lot of tissue is redundant, that is, you can afford in some ways to lose some of the lung and still function properly. If you do that, you get a lot of your lung function back, and you can transfer air much more easily, oxygen much more easily into your bloodstream.
It's resilient, the human body.
You give it a chance, and it'll heal.
Yeah. Ryan in Armprior.
Yes, hello, guys.
Hi.
Quick question. I have the gastro bug that's been going around. I also have Crohn's, and unfortunately, I don't have the luxury of calling in sick. So is there anything I can do to alleviate my symptoms to make it a little more comfortable?
Well, part of the issue is you have Crohn's disease. Is the Crohn's active or in remission?
It's just coming out of remission. It's coming into remission.
Okay.
Then I picked up this bug, early this morning.
Yeah, without knowing exactly the extent of the disease that you've had, all I can say is that the intestinal bug, the viral bug that causes that the gastro will, it runs its course, right? So all you can do, and what you have to be vigilant about, is that it doesn't exacerbate the symptoms of your Crohn's disease. But the infection itself that you have, you can't change the natural history of that. All you can do for it is to maintain be hydrated as well as you can and avoid dehydration. But the Crohn's disease complicates it. So if the bowel is damaged, if you see any bleeding, mucus, more cramps, even developing fevers, you have to actually have that assessed at the hospital because you have what we call a comorbid condition. So it's something that can be made worse by the viral infection. So I understand completely what you're trying to say with regards to reducing or trying to get through things that things getting worse.
Alleviating the symptoms.
But the natural history of this disease, that is the viral gastroenteritis you have, is one that doesn't change despite what we do. There's no medication you can take. You have to be careful about taking medications that can slow down diarrhea. If you're not having any cramps, you can use that. But again, you have to speak to your physician first to see if it's okay. But otherwise, if there's cramps, you really can't use anything to slow the bowel down because that actually can cause more damage. And I just wanted to answer that other question from that gentleman, Rob, about tickling the feet and the kids.
Sure.
No, there's no harm. Have fun with your kids.
Okay. Brian in Orleans.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
Hi. I had a heart attack in 2005, a near fatal heart attack. Okay.
Okay.
And I've been on heart medications ever since. Right now, I'm on Coversil.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on metoprolol, I guess it's called.
Metoprolol. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the equivalent of Lipitor.
Right. Atorvastatin.
And a baby aspirin. Okay?
Right.
Anyway, a short time ago, I ran into a friend that had lost over 100 pounds, and he told me about this book that he had read. And anyway, it's called Wheat Belly by Dr. William Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, cut out the wheat and lose your wheat belly. The book was fabulous. But in the book, I guess it's based on a low-carb diet type of thing, okay? Mm-hmm. And I started the diet now, the wheat belly diet, two months ago, and I've lost 30 pounds so far.
Mm-hmm.
But in the book, the one point I want to bring out is in the book it mentions that, he mentions that with proper exercise and with cutting the wheat completely out of your diet, which I have, wheat and wheat products, that I can eventually be taken off of my heart medications and blood pressure medications completely. Does that make sense, or does that sound like it could happen?
Probably not. And the reason is that you've already had a heart attack.
Yes.
So the underlying, what we call pathophysiology or the mechanism of the disease is still present in the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So although you're taking medications, the medications, what they're doing, for example, the atorvastatin or the Lipitor,
yes,
is reducing your cholesterol level to a point where it tries to reverse the accumulation of plaques that are in the coronary arteries.
Yes.
Those plaques are still there. Even though you had the heart attack and you're being treated, your body has a propensity to put those plaques into your coronary arteries. And we know that diet in and of itself is only going to affect about 15% of the cholesterol level in terms of reduction.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to have the same effect as the atorvastatin in reducing your risk of a future heart attack.
Okay.
So the weight loss is fabulous. I think that's great. I think the you know, diet in itself is, it's more just reducing your calories. So it's not necessarily the food someone chooses to eat or not eat. It's just the quantity of the food and the calories that it adds up to. I think it's excellent that you're being proactive to do this, but in terms of making a statement in the book to say that you could get off the medications if you have heart disease, I would say that if you have never had a heart attack, and by going through this diet and doing the exercise, and if your blood values were really good, and but again, you had never had a heart attack, that would be a different story. Then yes, you can take people off medications. But having had a heart attack in the past already doubles your risk of heart disease again. So it's a Russian roulette thing by stopping those medications, because again, the initial conditions that cause the heart and the heart damage is still there. And the heart, having had a heart attack, there is still a part of the heart that is not active at all. So you have to, what you're trying to do is preserve as much function as you can over the long term.
Very, very quickly, Carol, what's your question for Dr. Dworkin?
My 8-year-old daughter has severe allergies to cats and dogs to the point where she was exposed a couple of months ago, and it required 2 ER visits with putting her on prednisone.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to look into allergy shots, but I understand it's a long process and the benefit might not be there. So I wanted you to comment on the benefit of allergy shots for cats and dogs and any possible long-term risks.
Sure. Well, immunotherapy is a long process. It usually starts off with, it's a graduated increase in the allergens, that is the actual compounds that cause the allergic reaction. You start at very, very minute quantities or dilutions, and you gradually build up over time, building up week by week. Usually it's an injection each week for at least 35 weeks, followed by an injection after that every 2 to 3 weeks, and some of this can go on for years. Each time you go in for the injection, you have to wait about 15 to 30 minutes in the office to ensure that there's no allergic response. So it's a huge time commitment. And also for a child to get those shots all the time, they get used to it after a while, but it can be traumatic at the beginning if you're giving those shots. In terms of immunotherapy, in general, immunotherapy has about an 80% success rate. So it's 4 to 5 times, but it is a large time commitment to find that out. Given the severity of the reaction, you know, I would certainly speak to an allergist about it, see what they think about the success rate, whether there's anything else that they can suggest with regards to mitigating some of the allergic response other than, you know, eliminating the dog and cat from the vicinity. But, you know, there's dogs and cats everywhere.
Yep.
But ultimately, yeah, you're absolutely correct. It is a time commitment. It does work for many people, in fact, the majority. But nevertheless, should be discussed with your allergist just to see if there's anything else that they can recommend in conjunction with it.
That's it. Right out of time. In fact, we even had to stretch things out a little bit today. You're back on Sunday?
I am back on Sunday.
Sundays at 4 for the Sunday House Call with Dr. Dworkin and Health Headlines every morning at 10 to 7 during Madeley in the Morning.